Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. Hello and welcome once again to another Trademark podcast, joined again today by two comrades, Sean Byers of Trademark and Stuart McGill. We're doing episode 7, I think, of WTF, What the Fuck is the Stock Market? I'm still not entirely sure what it is, but we're going to have another go today to explain some other aspects of it. We've seen over the last couple of weeks since our last podcast, inflation's made a dramatic comeback everywhere, it seems. Central banks, however, are still continuing to buy vast amounts of their own government's debt. They don't really know how to stop doing that. Talk of an era of cheap money is all talk, and we haven't seen much movement on that. Energy prices are through the roof, of course. Coal has doubled in price, for example, over the last couple of weeks in commodity markets. As Stuart spoke about last time, most industries are still suffering supply crunches and supply chain problems. Microchips can't be got anywhere. Labor's becoming hard to find for the capitalist class. Bitcoin is crashing. And Russia and NATO are fucking about in Ukraine. Oh, and there's also a little subject of a bit of a stock market crash yesterday. So there's plenty to be getting on with, plenty to be talking about. And we might throw in something else at the end of the day if anyone's getting the information on it, because I did get a couple of questions about Evergrande. What the fuck's happened to Evergrande in China? What's the latest on that one? Because it was the top of our agenda for a while, top of everyone's agenda for a while, but it seems to have disappeared off. If anyone's got any clues as to what's going on there, feel free to share them with the vast amount of people who listen to this podcast. I mean, the millions, lads, millions of people listen to this fucking podcast now. I think we were 223rd on the Danish list of most popular podcasts last month. So look, you know what I mean?
David Hasselhoff, but what's Denmark?
We are the David Hasselhoff of fucking podcasts in Europe. Yeah. We were 186 in Spain. So there you go. You know what I mean? So we're popular in Spain. So look, I'll give you the full league table. We're the Crystal Palace of the podcast world. You know what I mean? Mid-table, not doing too well. Won't get relegated, you know? All right, look. We'll start off with yesterday's stock market crash, lads. Sean, over to you. It was come out of the blue. Seems to have rallied a little bit today. But what have you got to say about it, and what does it tell us about the contemporary state of global capitalism?
Yeah, for the past while, we've been seeing signs of a bubble, or a super bubble, as some people are calling it. So what we're talking about is speculation on everything under the sun: property, debt, big tech, cryptocurrencies. Everything. Some people have used the example of Dogecoin. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I wonder how you pronounce that. I was calling it Doggy Coin, but yeah, my missus looked at me and said, don't be calling it Doggy Coin.
Bit of a debate about that. But Dogecoin basically began as a joke, as a parody between some lads before going on to reach a market value of 90 billion because Elon Musk was talking about it. Just ridiculous. Which is just sort of a symptom of how crazy things were getting. And this speculation, of course, that we've talked about this in the past, has been supported by cheap credit provided through quantitative easing of central banks. And it's clearly resulted in a massive overvaluation in the stock market. At its height, the Standard & Poor's 500, the biggest stock market in the world, was valued 22 times the earnings of the companies that it represented. And so quite a few people were saying, look, these stock prices are eventually going to have to come into line with economic reality. And that'll take the form of a correction, is what they call it. And that's what we've seen yesterday and in the last week. Global stock markets have had their worst week in a year. The US stock markets have been hit the hardest. The S&P 500 is down 10% from the start of the year. The NASDAQ, which is heavily sort of tech-oriented, has lost 16% since the start of the year. And the tech companies are taking the biggest hammer. So like you're not just talking about startups, you're talking about the big players as well, like Amazon, Zoom, Twitter, Spotify, Apple, Intel, Tesla, they're all down. And the bad news for us, Stevie, is that our workplace pensions hit pretty bad.
Let me interrupt. I was going to ask you, because the question we always get asked when we're doing this, whether we're doing it in a podcast or whether we're doing it through our training and education courses in trade unions, is how does that affect me? How does all these rises and crashes in stock markets, it all seems to people to be so abstract. How does it affect working people?
Well, that's it. I mean, our our whole lives are totally bound up in this. If you go and look at our workplace pension, people's pension, which is a good pension provider, like, but if you look at their pension funds, the things that they're invested in, they're mainly invested in the US stock market, and a massive chunk of it is in tech. So if you look at the top 10 holdings of our pension fund, it is Amazon, Tesla, Microsoft. It's all of these tech companies that have been hit bad. So our pension fund's taking a hit. Like,
but that means surely, Stuart, and just, I know this is an aside, but I don't mind going down this road. Surely that if a pension fund takes a hit now because of a massive crash in the stock market yesterday, it will come back before the end of the year potentially. So then your pension's back up again then, isn't it? That stupid cunt hasn't got his mic turned on. Look. I mean, look, there you go. Go on.
Sorry, guys. I was just getting concerned then. Stephen's introduction got me so fucking depressed. I thought I'm going to cast a pension in and just spend it all on blackjacks. I think things regarding the stock market and pensions, I'm not quite so pessimistic as some other people. When you look at some of the fundamentals, I mean, I just read something this morning in the FT. The US market's more overvalued than it was in 1929, 1973, and 2007. All right, which obviously is problematic. But when you look at earnings, some of the fundamentals, US corporate earnings, 43% for 2021. The UK is 73% increase in corporate earnings. So the fundamentals don't look too bad. I mean, certainly there will be a tapering off, and in the end, the free money from the governments will stop. And that does have the stock market somewhat jittery, which is why I think the overvalued tech stocks took a big dive yesterday. But remember, things have come back today to a large extent because there still is some good value in the market out there on both sides of the Atlantic. You were talking about what does the stock market tell us about the way the capitalism works. The post office apparently has led a bit of a rally in the UK today because they've announced they're going to lay 700 people off, which has pleased the guys in the stock market. So there is that. And also, yeah, Omicron has had a real impact. The big question remains now, when Omicron wears off, will growth go back? Because growth still looks pretty good. And to be honest, inflation over the years, inflation does pretty good for the stock market. Bond market doesn't do so good because the bond market is fixed income. So over the years, stocks perform pretty well alongside inflation, as does other commodities. All right. But again, commodities don't pay a dividend. So at the moment, I remain reasonably optimistic for stocks, less so for bonds. There's one guy, Jeremy Grantham, who's been forecasting complete and utter crash for decades. I think I sent you guys something about him yesterday. At some point, he could be right. But the fact is, there remains a huge economic surplus. And at the moment, the equities market is the place to put it in. When you look at the earnings you get from equities compared to the earnings which are likely from bonds, the big alternative investment, equities remain well on top. So that's a long way of saying, don't despair, guys. Your old age, you should be able to afford some stout.
Here, I don't know why Sean was bringing up our fucking pension scheme, because it's worth fuck all anyway. I worked out last week that if I worked till 67, if I lived till 67 and worked till 67, my pension would be worth $3,500 a year. So I don't really give a fuck whether the stock market goes up or down. What's more important to me is that my potatoes grow and my polytunnel produces chilies and tomatoes, because that's what I'll be fucking living on when I'm 67. Anyway, look, so Stuart, not too pessimistic. Sean's slightly more pessimistic. I think Sean's pessimistic as well, though, because the next question goes to him, because there's something that he had an interest in, is that parts of that stock market are clearly Ponzi scheme level speculation going on. Not all of it, but parts of it. And one of the ones we wanted to talk about briefly, because we've got a few questions in about this, was that the crash in shitcoin, or Bitcoin as some know it as. It's the favoured commodity of well, who exactly? I was actually looking this up last night. I thought, who is it? Who are the kind of... In case anyone wants to know what happened there, Stuart just gave a big wanker sign to the screen there. We should have this on video. Who's involved in Bitcoin? But I looked it up, and there was a big piece of research done recently about the kinds of people involved in the Bitcoin world. And the average Bitcoin user is a 32-year-old libertarian male, to which I'll add incel probably at the end of that kind of demographic list. Apparently computer programmers are involved in it, obviously, mainly because there's significant rewards if you're involved in the commercial aspects of mining Bitcoin. There's loads of money involved in it, billions actually. I had no idea it was that fucking big. Speculators obviously are involved in Bitcoin. And that's your normal standard speculators, because they dip into Bitcoin markets every now and again because it's so volatile. So there's risk there, which means there's also potential for profit. Libertarians are there, of course, people who think they're on some sort of fucking political crusade to bring back, I don't know, unadulterated, crony-free capitalism or some bollocks. And of course, criminals. I mean, the dark web is a space for criminals to engage, you know, arms, drugs, children, pornography, all the rest of that kind of shit that goes on there. And to us as Marxists with various views, of course, cryptocurrency is just a Ponzi scheme. It's a scam, isn't it, Sean? Over to you.
Yeah. Well, to start off with, like, Bitcoin's much more volatile than anything else, or cryptocurrencies are much more volatile than anything else you invest in, really. And that's why when it takes a hit, it tends to take a big hit. It takes a big drop. And that's what happened. It's down 20% in a week, now valued at $33,000, which is a long way off the sort of $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 that some of its advocates have been predicting not so long ago. Some of the other cryptocurrencies have taken an even bigger hit. Now, we're a long way off from the likes of Bitcoin challenging the traditional role of, you know, normal currencies. But crypto assets are now represent about 1% of total global financial assets. Like, so that's a sizable proportion. They've grown massively in the last few years as people search out alternative means for or avenues for investing. And they've become big enough to act as a source of financial instability. And you can see that in some places where there are big crypto markets. So Russia's talking, it has one of the biggest crypto markets in the world, is talking about introducing a ban on crypto trading because it's worried about punters withdrawing their savings from the financial sector and the real economy and putting them into cryptocurrencies. The Bank of England has even weighed in and is calling for stricter regulation. And like, they have a right to be concerned because, as you said, Stevie, like, what we're talking about here is a socially useless, environmentally destructive, and highly unstable vehicle for speculation that serves no other purpose. Like, it's even useless as a store of value, like a normal currency, because it's not backed by anything. It's not backed by the state, most importantly.
Well, it's not a currency in that essence, is it? Because it's denominated in dollars still. It's not a currency in its own right.
Yeah, it's not used to price anything except other cryptocurrencies. And very, very few companies accept it as a means of payment. Like, so you said, it's a giant Ponzi scheme, and that's exactly how it operates. You can't just cash out your chips like you ordinarily could, because the cash reserves aren't there for you to do so. You're dependent on another mug, another investor coming in to take your place so you can cash out. And that's exactly how a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, it's kind of an online incel equivalent of the pyramid schemes that used to come around a boozer once every 6 years. And you still get people in the boozer going, oh, this is a new scheme, you have to get everyone out. And you're sitting there going, oh, fucking don't. But then your uncle did it, or your dad, or your fucking brother got involved and they lost the shirt off their back. This is no different, because once that pyramid scheme stops recruiting new people at the base of it, the whole thing collapses at the top. Stuart, it's not just shitcoin, though, is it? I mean, there's loads of cryptocurrencies. I mean, I don't know the names of all of them. I know there are loads of them now, but it's kind of a craze nearly now to set up a new cryptocurrency, because you can raise money from investors and then you can dump it and leg it with all their money. I think they call it pump and dump. I was reading yesterday, I think it was in Jacobin. I read an article the other day, pump and dump. I mean, it's just a craze, isn't it? And it is a pyramid scheme, and they are going to collapse.
Absolutely. And also, as I may have indicated beforehand, I thought secretly in between us, the people that are into it are a bunch of tossers, I've got to say. I don't know anybody who's into this whole gig who isn't a bit of a wanker in some basis, and often quite a libertarian basis, which I know that's a somewhat emotional reaction to it, but it's unfortunately true.
Having said that, Stuart, how's your cryptocurrency portfolio getting on?
It was doing pretty well until yesterday, unfortunately. That's why I'm bitter and twisted today. See, the thing is, it is a purely speculative investment. So whenever things look like they might get a little bit testy, let's get back to what Sean was saying, you're going to get out of crypto, which was there was that big fallout yesterday, because you don't want to think, fucking hell, things are looking pretty rough here. I know, rather than put it into gold, I'll stick it into crypto. Why would you do that? So you get rid of the crypto stuff immediately. And I do know some people in this business who are not complete wankers, and they did that yesterday. It's the sensible thing to do, because you know that's the one that is going to drop. All of them are related to Bitcoin to a large extent, which is by far the biggest one. You can't pay your tax in it. That's the big thing. I don't want to get too much into the MMT ideas here, but certainly a currency which you can pay your tax in is the one you want to go use. You can't pay your tax in it, and there's no stable means of converting it into regular currency. Why would you bother with crypto apart from speculative investment?
Good man, Stuart. Thanks for that. Very, very clear definitions there. One of the things, of course, that's important for understanding cryptocurrencies, and particularly Bitcoin, is the environmental damage and the environmental cost of it. I mean, I was, again, reading up on this about that most Bitcoin mining is now commercial mining farms that are big, big operations using something in the region of 1% of global fucking electricity use. In the midst of climate breakdown and, you know, and energy concerns, it's time the whole thing was fucking put to death, really, and fucking regulated out of existence, or just fucking banned, or just barred. The Russians and the Chinese have got it right on that one, I think. Look, that's Bitcoin done, shitcoin done. So get your money out of it if you're stupid enough to have fucking invested anything in it, you dopey bastards. We're moving on swiftly to a bit of geopolitics and to a discussion about energy and energy prices. That's kind of what we wanted to talk about today, actually. We went off on a bit of a wander there with shitcoin, but I enjoyed that. Just firstly, Sean, over to you. Look, World War III, apocalypse, Ukraine, Russia, or just a bit of saber rattling? What's going on over there?
Yeah, I mean, what you're looking at really is part of a longer struggle for influence over a country that's strategically positioned in the region. Like, so if you take a longer view, what actually frames this whole dispute is the challenge that an autonomous Russia poses to the US and NATO's expansion in the East. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of the former Soviet republics have been gradually absorbed by the EU and NATO. And they've made it their business to try to make Ukraine and Belarus and then parts of Central Asia the next part of that puzzle. And that is something that, you know, Russia has responded to. I'm not going into the whole causes of the initial conflict, but that's basically what brought that to pass. The escalation of the past year can be explained by a couple of things, really. Like, so in the first place, it's clear like Putin is definitely at it. Like, you know, Russia's in a trouble economically. He's in a bit of trouble economically. Russia's under pressure to sustain its welfare settlement. Putin's losing a bit of ground in the polls, and some would say he's desperate to project an image of strength for domestic political purposes to give himself a bit of a bump. That's what he did with Crimea, and it had the desired effect. At the same time, Russia has legitimate concerns about the way the US is going about trying to reassert itself in the face of the Chinese challenge, I suppose. And there's concerns within Russia that the US might encourage a nationalist Ukrainian government to do something stupid and provoke a confrontation. Like, so there's saber rattling going on both sides of the equation, but it has to be framed within that longer view of your EU and NATO expansion into the East.
I love the British minister, I can't remember his name, is it Gavin Williamson or someone, who says, we're going to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Ukraine, but we're not going to send any troops. Like, I thought, that's not very fucking shoulder to shoulder, is it? Like, you know, Stuart, what about Russia, Ukraine? It is, obviously, there's geopolitics going on there, Sean said, and there's ongoing issues there around global power and global allegiances. But it also has an effect, of course, on the economy and on the markets as well, because I think it's about 40% of the natural gas consumed by Europe comes from Russia. And there's a new pipeline opening up, is there not, between Russia and Germany? And I noticed the Germans have been very, very quiet about what's going on in the Ukraine. I think they sacked the minister the other day, didn't they, for saying something positive about Putin, saying it was a top geezer or whatever he said about him. And there's, I mean, even the Brits were flying over arms to Ukraine and they couldn't use German airspace, which I was really surprised about. They had to go around Germany to deliver arms to Ukraine. So clearly, if what he wants to do is to cause tension and splits at the heart of the European Union and NATO, he's been quite successful there, it seems to be. But it's more, a lot of it's about energy, a lot of it's about gas and oil, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. A few things to remember here. I think something like 50% of the Russian federal revenues are derived from oil and gas. So sales are pretty important to Putin, very important indeed. Also, with the United States, always think about the dough. They've got a lot of LNG they want to flog. And for them, Germany...
Liquefied natural gas.
Liquefied natural gas. LNG is. And they're pushing that. Someone I saw a while ago from the export, I think they're equivalent of the export department in America, said that LNG will soon become used as a tool of American foreign policy. So there is that element there. Both Biden and Putin need some diversion from some quite serious domestic problems. Putin cannot afford to go ahead and be seen as weak. So he needs to posture here. But really, does anybody do well by invading anybody in that area in January and February? Is he really going to go ahead and go in there now and try and take over a country with a pretty seriously sized armed force that will get him bogged down? He's going to have to go ahead and get conscripts to come in. They're going to go ahead and get regular guys in the street to fight the war. So I find it very difficult to understand why Putin would do this other than as a bit of a posture. I could be wrong. In terms
of, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that if Putin wanted to invade Russia, he'd have done, or Ukraine, he'd have done it already.
You would certainly have thought
all this bullshit on the BBC about a lightning strike, a blitzkrieg on fucking Kiev. You're like, well, I think the name blitzkrieg gives it away, mate. If they wanted to do it, they'd have done it already.
Yeah, they've got 100,000 soldiers, supposedly. That's not going to go ahead and take over a big nation like Ukraine with a lot of people there who are going to fight. Some very, very dodgy people like the Azov Battalion, by the way, who are not the sort of people that we want to be associated with. But really, we don't give a shit long as you take care of our own geopolitics.
I was at an anti-fascist conference in Germany a couple of years ago, and I was up at a podium, there was about 300 people, and I was doing my speech. And I mentioned the Azov Battalion in Ukraine and how we shouldn't be supporting fascists in Ukraine. And the mic was turned off. And I was told, we're not here to talk about the Ukraine. Talk about bad people in Britain. Talk about UKIP and fascists in Denmark. But then we talked about the Ukraine. So, yeah. Look, I wanted to, what about the oil and gas, though? What about that bit? What about the pipeline? What about...
Just moving on to that, mate. So I just want to say one thing more about geopolitically. There's a guy in Ukraine, because not everybody in Ukraine thinks the same. We tend to look at them as some kind of monolith. This guy, Oleksiy Danilov, who's the Secretary of the National Defense Security and Defense, he said that he thinks this is all about what's all connected to geopolitical and domestic processes in the West, and that the buildup of Russian troops isn't as rapid as some claim. So there are some people even in Ukraine who are saying, you know, calm down. This is all a little bit of bullshit here. In terms of the economic impact, I was having a look at this for this podcast because it might not seem like it, but I do sometimes prepare for the meeting. And the oil price hasn't been pumping up the way you would expect with a crisis like this on the way. And what seems to have happened is there's been a general market correction. The guy here says, well, fundamental and political forces remain positive for crude oil. These appear to be getting overwhelmed by market forces, which means basically people are coming out of something like oil and they're getting into gold and other safer stuff like gold and bonds. But the concern, the residual concern about what could happen in Ukraine is keeping the oil price at a level higher than it otherwise would have been. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, I was looking at that myself yesterday. But I mean, obviously, government bonds are a safe haven for your assets, and that's one of the potential consequences, I suppose, of instability is people pulling their money out of more volatile markets and whacking it back into bonds, because the bond markets, as you know, have been very low for a long time.
But also gold prices get screwed by inflation, though.
Yeah, exactly. So gold and platinum and silver are fucking rocketing at the moment, because so people are getting scared. But the other thing in that domestic issue you raise, that apparently petrol prices and diesel prices in the States are going through the fucking roof, and that's catastrophic for Biden. So, you know, the idea that he would add price to that, or make moves, if you like, with Russia that would actually make the price of oil go up in America, would be domestically catastrophic for him. So that's why the indications are this is just a lot of fucking saber rattling, isn't it? Because he couldn't afford it electorally.
Well, yeah, look, not just in the US, but within the EU, there's not going to be any real appetite for even greater energy shortages or increased prices. They'll drive up the price of everything else, you know, from food to the transport.
Well, the Republic of Ireland has some of the highest prices in the world for petrol and diesel at the pumps at the moment. You know, some of the highest prices on the planet are in Europe now for putting petrol in your car, but also a lot of the heating in the south relies on gas as well. A lot of that gas comes from Russia too. So, yeah, you're right.
No, and then you have fucking morons like Don O'Brien writing in the paper saying that we should be tooling up to fucking invade Russia.
Yeah. I'd be more than happy to crowdfund him, to get him some gear, get him some khaki, get him some guns, a hat if he wants one. We'll just send him over there as a one-man fucking SAS team or whatever the Rangers, Ogle na Héireann call it, the Irish Army, I think it's called the Rangers. Get him to join the Rangers and just embed him with the Rangers and get the Rangers sent over there. We'll wait for his fucking swift demise. The other thing, I suppose, that comes out of Ukraine and Russia, of course, apart from oil and natural gas, which is the big issue, is any interruption of the flow of grain out of that Black Sea region, Stuart. We talked last time about commodity prices and commodity brokers. They're going to be loving this, I suppose, aren't they, because of the instability, because although there's huge risks involved in trading in these big commodities at the moment, there's also potentially massive profits, particularly if they've already bought, as you said, bought futures in those markets. They're going to make fucking fortunes because the prices of all of these commodities are only going one way, and that's up. So if you've bought the next 2 or 3 years of grain from fucking, I don't know, Ukraine or Russia or Kazakhstan or Romania, those are the big four I was reading in terms of wheat production, you're going to make a killing. But it also means that food inflation, which is already up, will continue to rise, doesn't it?
It's going to be a very good time to be long in grain. And I suspect that our friends we were talking about in the last podcast will be doing particularly well at the moment. Probably a few more millionaires created there. But you're quite right. That's going to put prices up everywhere. And also the gas. What people neglect about the increase in gas is it's used quite a bit by various industrial firms. It's not just the domestic gas thing which is an issue. So British Steel, all sorts of people have said that they have real issues right now. So we'll come on to this when we discuss energy prices.
Well, we're moving straight into energy now, mate, because obviously all of this political instability has an impact on prices, has an impact on production, has an impact on food inflation, all the rest of it. Commodity traders will make money regardless of what happens there, because they're in the middle of it. They'll be hedging all around themselves and buying up. But to normal punters, this means more inflation. This means higher energy costs. This means higher food costs. And let's talk about the UK market specifically, I suppose, at the moment. The Irish market doesn't have as many suppliers, but it's equally high in terms of energy prices. I think Britain is the highest energy prices in Europe, but the Republic's a close second or third. Now, we know that the British market in terms of energy is fucking rotten to the core. Every week we seem to be hearing about another company that's going out of business. And I read again only last night there were something like 70 companies operating in the British energy market, which seems inordinately too many, you know, for one small market like that. They reckon there might be 10 that will survive, obviously with a much larger market share after the other 60 go out of business. I mean, why is it, Stuart, that so many small operators were allowed to crowd into such a highly competitive market? And why have they all collapsed?
I think they wanted to show it was a genuinely competitive market and to show that most markets where you have a real lack of competition tend to have big barriers to entry. They thought, let's show that anybody can come into this and make a good go of it. Of course, in reality, that's bullshit. Interesting looking at the most recent entrant who's doing pretty well and getting a big name, Octopus. Don't make any money. At the moment, they say they're investing in stuff and they're investing in the technology, and they are a bit more of a tech firm than an energy firm. But at the moment, they are losing. But they have enough backers behind them, they may be able to survive and become one of the big players. But the whole thing about new entry was all about getting smaller punters in there. The smaller punters had many problems, one of which was they didn't have enough wherewithal and enough resource to go ahead and hedge properly. So they became highly dependent on the spot prices. And when the spot prices started going extremely north, they got completely shafted. They weren't hedged and didn't have the resources. So they've all gone tits up, which was a kind of grinding inevitability. It happened a little bit quicker than some people thought, but it was always going to take place.
Yeah. And one of the things are that rising prices, and that we've seen some of the global reasons, if you like, for those rising prices, that's not the only reason why some of these companies, that's the main reason why the companies have gone out of business and why, but it's not the only reason why prices for consumers is rising, is it? There are other issues. What are some of the other issues about prices rising? Are some of these large companies and commodity traders not making lots of money out of this at the moment? I mean, could they soak up some of those price rises is the question.
Oh my God, yes, certainly. So, well, we're talking about inflation or about the gas prices here. Maybe we'll come on to inflation a bit later. But the reason for, there are various reasons why gas prices have risen, all to do with them. With a drought in Brazil, which caused some problems, a balmy summer in Asia Pacific, which caused a big demand for air conditioning, pent up demand after 2020, which was a particularly quiet time for obvious reasons, and of course some technical reasons like they closed some places down in anticipation of demand staying low wind summer, etc. But there are all these factors behind why gas prices increased. You have to remember China. Right. 7 million people added to the gas network in 2020. And that was in 2021. And that was relatively quiet, given the early part of the year was quite subdued. I think a 21% increase in liquefied natural gas demand in China, 2021 compared to 2020, compared to an 8% increase in Western Europe. So this was always going to happen whenever big parts of the world, which previously had been relatively backward, for want of a better term, were to get industrialized, to get more wealthy, and they put greater demands on energy. South Korea as well, places like that. I mean, if everybody were to go ahead and industrialize and get as wealthy as China and South Korea, we have some major issues.
Yeah, we're going to run out of energy, aren't we? But I mean, the question I wanted to ask as well is about profitability. I mean, why have 82% of profits in energy companies gone to dividends in the last 5 years? I mean, they're making massive amounts of money, but they're not necessarily reinvesting, are they? They're just using the energy market as a cash cow. Which is the same picture as we've spoken about over the last 7 podcasts. That's the same picture in every part of the market, isn't it?
When you look at gas bills, they've risen by 50% since 1996. And the average profit margins with the big suppliers has grown from, I think it was 1% in 2009. 2017, it has got as high as 4%. It's probably even higher now, though it's going to be challenged by some of the cost increases. This is a good business to be in. This is one of the reasons why the hedge funds and others love them. I'm reading here, utility stocks are some of the most popular buy and hold stocks on the market because they offer high dividends and they tend to outperform other sectors in times of economic uncertainty. And that's from some investment magazine. Whenever I suggest to some of my friends who are still in the business about nationalizing utilities, they get very pissed off. Good, reliable stock makes a lot of money for them. It's a mature stock, so you're never going to get the big speculative growth, but you will get the dividends. So this is a long way of saying that's why the dividends grow. To keep the investors happy, shoot the dividends out there. Also, as we've discussed, there's been significant share buybacks over the last 10 years, in the last 5 years in particular. So you've got to compete with that in terms of distributing the largesse to your investors.
Yeah, it's incredible when you say it like that and when you show how much money is made from utilities, and because they're a safe bet, and they're a safe bet because basically it's a monopoly for capital, isn't it? Because they yep. control this market. Yes, there might be 5 or 6 or 70 suppliers, but really that's the capitalist class just extracting money from us, from the working class, from the people, and they can do that because they have control over those markets. And we all know what the solution to these things are. The solution is, of course, is nationalisation. I mean, I know that Sunak's already talking in the UK about subsidising private energy so that they don't pass on the current energy price rises onto consumers. In the Republic of Ireland, they've just agreed €113, you know, kind of benefit to families to again, subsidising the price of €220 million in total to subsidise the price of energy. It's basically another emergency bailout. In fact, there are quite a lot of similarities actually between what's going on in the energy market now and what went on in the banking and finance industry in 2007 before the last global financial crash, in terms of lack Absolutely. Of regulation, in terms of speculative practices and so on. And of course, they know, as the banks knew in 2007, that you can't let energy crash. So the government has to step in and bail these fuckers out. So they're doing it on purpose, knowing that they're going to be bailed out, which is the thing that's most annoying for us, of course. But what it reminds us, of course, Sean, I'll come to you on this one, is that this is, in essence, how state monopoly capitalism works, isn't it? This is, in essence, how the capitalist class uses the state as a means to extract wealth from everybody else. Even when they're supposedly on the myth of capitalism is that the great entrepreneurs and these shareholders take massive risks, and if the risks pay off, they benefit. But actually what happens is if the risks don't pay off, they benefit as well because the state steps in and bails us out. Is this not just a really good example of state monopoly capitalism?
Well, yeah, certainly in Britain, like the energy market is state monopoly capitalism in action. Like, you have a small, very small number of big hitters that totally have emerged and got themselves in a position where they control the market with the support of the state through the state's creation. Their profits, their dividends are protected at any cost, including through, as you said, Rishi Sunak's suggested subsidies, which is a price, an attempt at a price control without actually intervening in the working of the companies themselves. It's a transfer of public wealth to private wealth, and it's done through that sort of nexus between the state and those companies themselves. So it's a prime example of that in action. Like,
it's amazing what we've seen in Britain in particular, because Britain's the perfect example. I mean, it privatizes more stuff than any other state on the planet, it seems. It seems to be the home of it, the hub of it. Even when it's proved, of course, that these privatizations don't work. But we're talking about don't work in the sense of they do work. They do work for capital. Why? Because the state is constantly intervening to bail out these endless series of market failures in every fucking industry, you know, that exists. And we know what the solution is, don't we, Stuart? And we know that this constant intervention in a kind of dysfunctional and unstable market, it works for capital, doesn't work for the rest of the country, particularly with climate breakdowns, particularly with the concept of trying to move to, you know, zero carbon kind of energy within 30 years. What's the only option for us, really? And what won't they do?
Right. In terms of what you're talking about, the climate, one of the things we haven't really talked about with this 82% figure is the fact that this is money which could have been used to invest in a sustainable future. Yeah. But it's all gone to already wealthy people who are going to spend it all on whatever wealthy people
football
spend.
Football club. So buy another fucking football club or a super yacht.
Yeah, or some dick-shaped rocket to go ahead and take off in the sky. Yeah, so that's a massive opportunity cost. In terms of what we need to do in the short term, And I don't want to sound like a guest on fucking Graham Norton here, but I'm going to plug the forthcoming pamphlet we have coming out next week, all right, about energy prices. But in the short term, what I think we need to do is recognize that we cannot go on subsidizing these fuckers in the interest of maintaining margins and in the interest of maintaining money for their shareholders. We tell them to freeze the prices. If this necessitates helping them out a little bit so they don't go out of business, fine. I've read somewhere it will cost $20 billion to keep prices where they are. I suspect that figure could be slightly out of date now. Fine, lend them 20 million, all right? Tell them keep prices where they are. Lend them 20 million at commercial rates and tell them you cannot pay any dividends over the next 5 or 6 years, because that will fuck up the share price, no doubt about that. Then it makes it more cheap to go ahead and nationalize them in the years to come. Now, in the long term, we need some kind of energy plan, which is consistent with a transport plan, which is consistent with a sustainable business plan for the country, and not just for the country, but for the planet as well. And you can only have that if you have a publicly owned energy business, which is whose goals are congruent with that of the country as a whole, not keeping
and indeed, and indeed of the future of the planet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think we can all agree that, yeah, I mean, if you're a member of or work for or vote for a political party that doesn't have a publicly owned energy system safeguarded from the whims kind of the market, then, you know, if you're voting for that party or a membership of that party, you really need to take a good fucking look at yourself in a mirror, because it is the only option, along with, as you said, other things like greening production and transport and so on. And that's the fucking fact. And so if you're not part of a social movement or a political party that talks about public energy, you need to start doing that.
Are you saying you can't vote Labour next time around?
Didn't say anything. I'm not telling people what to vote for, but no, don't fucking vote Labour next time. You'd be a mug if you fucking did, wouldn't you? I'll tell you what, though, we're going to finish on this point, because one of the things you brought up there, and we mentioned it before, is that energy is one example. And Sean, give that a brief definition of state monopoly capitalism and monopoly profits, because that's what happens when you have state monopoly capitalism. You have the state acting on benefit of the capitalist class and bailing it out every single time whenever it goes into market failure. But you also have this thing of monopoly profits. And there's been an awful lot of discussion. And just very briefly on this, Stuart, because we are running out of time. Inflation is obviously a massive issue here. We've looked at some of the issues around inflation in terms of food inflation, in terms of oil and gas price inflation, and the various geopolitical reasons for that, the various environmental reasons for that, which are always there to challenge us. But there's also this issue of monopoly profits, isn't there? And it's never spoken about in the mainstream press that the reason why inflation is going up is monopoly profits. Tell us a little bit about that.
Again, Graham, to go ahead and plug something, you can go ahead and check our pamphlet about this, which goes through it in some detail on the Communist Party of Britain page. When you look at
what?
Something
are you
like-
a member of the fucking... Sean, you never told me he was a fucking commie. I wouldn't have had him on a fucking podcast if I knew he was a commie. Jesus Christ, I thought you were a fucking good, solid social democrat. Anyway, carry on, you're here now.
Do I look and sound like a fucking social democrat? How fucking dare you? I'm not going to buy that decent fucking mic for the next podcast. When you look at this, just look at shipping. This is where the monopoly bit comes in here. The 10 largest shipping companies control more than 80% of the market. 51% in 2000. 80% now. Maersk. Huge increase in profits last year. I think 240% increase in profit. All the other fuckers in the market, huge increase as well. And I think that UNCTAD said that unless something happens about this, this will put an additional 1.5% on the inflation rate next year. Just shipping costs going up. American companies, we talked earlier about the big increase in the earnings. American companies now are making profit margins the fattest ever since 1950. So they're taking the opportunity of an awful lot of money flying around because of the government stimulus. And also people are talking about supply chain pressures, which are undoubtedly there, but they're taking the opportunity to go ahead and increase the prices. When you look at supermarket prices, Jack Monroe was talking about how much things went up last year. Have a look at how our big supermarkets are doing. Tesco, 20% increase in half-year dividend payouts to shareholders. They benefited by $532 million in the financial year from a business rates holiday. Sainsbury's, 23% increase in profits. We're talking earlier too about dividends. Oxfam did some research back in June. 98% of net profits of the biggest public listed supermarkets in Europe and America went to the shareholders through dividends and share buybacks. These guys have the capacity to absorb prices. They're passing it on to make more dough.
Yeah, so alongside the genuine reasons for inflation, which we've looked at before in terms of environmental changes, in terms of coming out of the pandemic, in terms of the kind of impact of Omicron, supply chain crunches, the inability of capital to find enough labour, alongside all those kind of genuine reasons, the one that's never spoken about, apart from on this podcast, is there's a thirst for that thirst for monopoly profits is a driver of inflation, and that's part of, that has to become part of the debate. John, did you want to come in there to, just to, on the end there, because we're going to finish on this point, mate?
Yeah, I think both of you just sort of provide a reminder that inflation is a class issue when it comes down to it. So whether you attribute the causes of inflation to the sort of the costs or to demand, the question you have to be asked is who pays for it? Who pays for inflation? Because who pays for it ultimately comes down to the balance of class forces and power relations in society. It comes down to whether the paying for inflation comes out of labour's share or capital share, you know. And there are some promising signs of organising within the trade unions in different places, Britain and elsewhere. But the reality is that workers' movements aren't as strong as they need to be pushing for wage increases in line with inflation. So like a repeat of the 1970s, doesn't look to be on the cards. And then there's bigger, wider political implications of how inflation is understood and who decides how it's addressed. And that can be seen in the US. This is going to have a major impact on workers' livelihoods and the livelihoods of the working class more generally. The right and even some Democrats have been using inflation mongering to cut Biden's stimulus program to shreds. So there's going to be a huge battle ahead of us. Both on the industrial front and the political front for control over who pays for inflation in the final.
I think we may have to return to this one and do a podcast on inflation. As boring as that sounds, but we know it's not, because inflation is not some sort of neutral economic metric that exists separate from class politics. As you both said, inflation is a class issue. Stuart, last word to you, mate, and then I'm closing this down.
Right. Inflation is a profit pull rather than a cost push issue. It is the desire of these companies to maintain the profit levels, which is pulling inflation up right now. When you look at the share of capital compared to labour over the last, since 1980, over the last 25 years, it's gone more and more to capital. So they do have the resources to go ahead and absorb these and still make some dosh. But this is all about the greed of the shareholders demanding returns, which has been, I guess, a leitmotif of the WTF series. This is the quintessence of capitalism. It's all about accumulating dosh for the people who have a lot of dosh already. And that fucks the rest of us.
Thanks very much for that, Sean. I'm glad you mentioned the leitmotif, because that would have been a serious lacuna at the heart of this podcast had you not.
Oh.
you can look it up. All the thickos listening can look that one up. LACUNA. Sean taught me that last week. That's the only reason why I'm using it. All right. Thanks very much, folks. I enjoyed that. That was a good crack. We shall return probably with another what the fuck is the stock market for? Although we are toying with the idea, and I'll say it here, I think this is the first time, a series of podcasts on imperialism. And what the fuck is imperialism and how we understand it? And we'll be returning here soon in a couple of weeks to talk to you about some of that stuff. So until then, slang or foil. That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and slang or foil.